level here. Talk into it for a second.
Rudyard Kipling.
Looks good.
Okay. That's good enough, huh?
Because the homecoming seems to generate that whole saga, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, let me get this about Joe off my mind first.
Okay.
Because there are two inaccuracies in your article.
Uh-oh.
And it wasn't your fault. It was Joe's fault. He misremembered. What brought us together was a lithograph of a house in an art gallery window in Beverly Hills. And I looked at it and said, oh, my God, that looks like, you know. And I recognize it as a house across the street from where I lived at Temple and Figueroa in downtown L.A., years before. And sure enough, it's part of the Heritage Square collection of Victorian houses now in L.A. But I was so madly in love with the lithograph, I went the next day and said, how much is that? They said, $75. Well, I couldn't afford that. I said, can I buy it on 3 monthly payments? They said, sure. They said, if you like that, you ought to come in there in the next room and see other work by Joe Manganini. So I went in the next room, and they had a huge painting, which you've seen in my living room, of that same house, which was selling for, I don't know, $200, something like that, which I also couldn't afford. And they said, then we've got a third painting here, which is even better. And over on the other wall was a painting of this train going nowhere on this giant trestle, which you've seen. And he made it into a lithograph later. But Joe seemed to recall that I saw a lithograph of that. No, I didn't. I saw the painting. So I said to her, oh, my God, I've got to have that, because it is a outline of a ghost of a story I've had in my head for the last 7 or 8 years, and which is something wicked, of course. Yeah. So I said, how much is it? She said, oh, I don't know, $300, $400, whatever it was. And I was in despair. So I said, can I have Mr. Manganini's address and phone number? I'd like to talk to him. So I got his phone number, and I called him and said, can I come up to visit? I'd love to see your studio. So he invited me up. And when I got there, I said, look, I'm crazy for your paintings. I just think they're so wonderful. But I can't afford to buy them at the price the gallery is offering. I said, now, when they sell something for $200, they take 50%. Is that correct? Yeah.
So
you get $100. Huh? And if it's a $400 painting, they keep $200 and you get $200. Correct? Yes. I said, God forbid, if the paintings don't sell, will you call me and I'll buy them from you for what you would have got? You see, there'd be no loss. The gallery wouldn't get their cut, but you would get everything, okay? And I said, it's the only way I can afford to buy the paintings. And even then, I have to buy them slowly over a period of months. Well, a month later, he called me. He said, come get the paintings. They didn't sell, and you can buy them from me. And it wasn't cheating the gallery. The gallery just didn't sell them, that's all. So I went up to his place and I got the paintings, and I paid part on each one. And I found out later that what he told me was not true. He pulled them out of the gallery on purpose to give them to me, you see. So it wasn't that they didn't sell. They could have sold, but he was so responsive to my enthusiasm, and we talked about illustrating books, that he pulled them out of the show and sold them to me. So that's how our friendship began, with an act of real friendship on his part, you know. And then I told him I had Golden Apples coming up, and I wanted him to do the cover, and I talked to Doubleday about it and got him a decent fee. And I told him I wanted some samples of a possible dust jacket design inculcating the Golden Apples metaphor. So I said, you know, one or two would be fine. He brought over 20 examples, fully painted, all ready to go, with the lettering and everything. I said, oh my God, Joe, you didn't have to do that. He said, oh, it got away from me, you know, and I got excited. So I still have most of those metaphors, those samples, the other 20 that we didn't use in the house somewhere. And so it started with that exhilarating thing. And then, of course, when Fahrenheit came up 2 years later, I looked at all of his sketches and I saw a sketch of Don Quixote in despair on a sort of, he was dressed in some newspapers and with a lot of newspapers under him, as I recall. And I said to Joe, look, this is so close to being the right metaphor for Fahrenheit. All you have to do is make a few changes, add a few books to the pile under his feet, make sure he's dressed in book type and newspaper type, and set him on fire. Huh? And so that's the kind of collaboration we had, and it's one of my favorite covers because it really indicates what the book is about. So that's what I wanted to clear up with you.
I'd love to expand this eventually,
and
I can incorporate.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the story is even better than he remembered it. And he'd forgotten how kind he was.
Is there some sort of an agreement on some of your publications that he illustrated, that whenever the book is reprinted, his illustrations go with
it? No, that, you can't guarantee that.
That's a shame.
They each have, well, you know, they each have their own art department.
Right.
And they want to take a crack at it if they're enthusiasts. I've often had wonderful experiences at UCLA and SC and other universities and high schools where they'll hand a book out to all the students in the art class and they'll turn in 40 illustrations for them. I have illustrations for Something Wicked This Way Comes done by 40 art students at UCLA. And then they did some work on, I think, The Illustrated Man and out at the Art Center in Pasadena. They did 40 covers for Fahrenheit, all different and all beautiful. I've got them put away. And then there's a type typography class also at Art Center in Pasadena who did artwork on Fahrenheit to different. They designed different types with different kinds of logos, and I put that away. So, you know, I'm just spoiled rotten all the time by these students and their teachers. Huh?
There's an awful lot of illustrators out there.
Who... Oh, yeah, and they're crazy to do. See, the great thing about my stories is they're all metaphor. No matter which one you pick up, you got something to illustrate. And that's not true. You know, you can't illustrate Catcher in the Rye or... And anything, any short stories, even though they're great. Great Day for Banana Fish by Salinger is a beautiful short story, but there's no metaphor, huh? So there's nothing to illustrate.
When I was in junior high, I did about 10 drawings for Dandelion Wine. And sent them to August Derleth.
Uh-huh.
And I have a letter back from him encouraging me to continue my work and maybe go to art school.
Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
In many ways, you generate a lot of things like that.
Oh, it's terrific.
I'm sure I'm typical.
Do you still have some of those?
Yeah, I still have them.
Maybe you could Xerox some.
Would you like to see them?
And send me a Xerox copy, sure.
That book made such a profound impression on me at just the right time.
Well, there were plans, Zeitlin and Verbrugge, antiquarian bookstore on La Cienega there 20 years ago made plans to put out a big special art edition of Dandelion Wine, and they had this artist do two sort of line drawings, and they were lovely. And then time passed and Mr. Zeitlin got sick and he finally died, and I went over there a couple of years ago and said, do you think you could try to find those two line drawings or etchings, whichever they were, and because they're just beautiful, and I'd like to buy them, you know. Well, they couldn't find them, you know. They got thousands and thousands of lithographs there. So they're still there, I think, on La Cienega. I haven't looked recently. I might go over and give it another try.
And I wanted to do drawings of Cece and Timothy and Uncle Einar. That was my favorite family.
Oh, sure. Well, it's just my family.
Yeah. Tell me about the connections there.
Well, I suppose my Aunt Neva is the closest thing to Cece because she was my real mother in many ways, who, as I've often said to you, took me to theater and the motion pictures and introduced me to the art world. And she studied at the Art Institute in Chicago. She made dresses for the Chicago Opera costumes. She designed costumes for the Streets of Paris exhibit show at the Chicago World's Fair in 1932-33. And so I was in her studio all the time, and it looked good and it smelled good because it smelled of oil paint. She painted pictures, she did watercolors, she designed dresses for people in Waukegan. So her studio was full of materials from every country in the world, you know, tweeds and silks and copies of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue. So I grew up looking at these women's style magazines, which gave me an edge when I got married to a woman who had four daughters. So I was able to buy clothes for them because I knew the difference between bad and good. I never had one of my daughters or my wife take any dresses back and turn them in. Not because they were being polite, but because they were right.
There's a lovely photograph of her in the Bradbury Companion. She must have been a beautiful woman.
Well, she's beauty's a strange thing. She's a handsome woman. She's handsome becomes beautiful. She has a sort of, I don't know what you'd say, almost an Egyptian nose, like a good size. It's one of the Bradbury noses. My nose is not a Bradbury nose. It's Swedish. It's from my mother's side of the family, the Mobergs, my Uncle Liner. But my father had a somewhat hawk-like nose, and Neva does too.
Did she live with the family group? In Waukegan, did she live?
We were all in the same block.
Same block.
I lived. I was born in 11 South St. James Street, and the corner, just to the right of us, 619 Washington Street, was my grandparents' house. And then around the block on Glen Rock Avenue, my Uncle Byron lived with his family. So I ran back and forth between the three houses. And the attraction at my Uncle Byron's house was all the Tarzan books and John Carter, Warlord of Mars. So I was always borrowing those, you know, and taking them back over to the house and reading them when I was 9 years old. And then over at my grandmother and grandfather's house, where he was a printer and publisher and newspaper editor, and he had a lot of classical books on various parts of history, some of which I own now. I have it in L.A., and histories of the Civil War and the photographs that came out of that war. And then in a special bookcase on one side of the parlor, my Aunt Neva had all of her fairy tale books and her Alice in Wonderland and all the Oz books. I grew up. So, see, the influences were fantastic. And the first book of fairy tales I got, my aunt gave me when I was 5 years old. I still have it. I dreamt about it the other night and got up in the morning, went in the other room and got it out and looked at it. And it's just gorgeous stuff with full color, full page color illustrations by a lady whose name I can't think of right now. But the first story in the book is Beauty and the Beast. And the Beast was a real beauty. he's almost terrible, but also beautiful, you know.
It seems very apt that you would transform her into a character like Cece, whose mind can go anywhere.
That's right. So, because of her influence, and she was my Dutch uncle, you see. If ever I got in trouble or I had something that worried me, I'd go to Neva and we'd sit and talk.
Was it unusual at that time in small towns to have families within a block?
I think we were fairly unusual. Huh. There may have been people who lived close to each other, but here we were, you know, within a few yards of each other. So Halloween was very special because we could celebrate in all the houses And we'd do over my grandmother's house, and my Aunt Neva and I would drive out in the country and get corn shocks and pumpkins and tote them back in and put them all over the house and up and down the stairs. It was this two-story house. And we put the insert boards from the dining room table on the staircase so you couldn't walk up. You had to slide down. You turned it into a slide. And in the, we fixed up the basement, and my Aunt Neva dressed me up as a witch and put warts all over my face and a crooked waxed nose, you know, and hid me down there so that when her friends showed up for the party, I'd jump out at them. Or I'd be up in the attic. She put me in the attic once playing my violin, you know, very, very poorly. So.
Well, I gather you were her favorite nephew then.
Oh, yeah. My brother was an athlete, and he had no time for any of this. But my aunt built miniature stages in her studio, and she carved out little characters. She wrote a play about a Chinese emperor and a magician, and the whole...
Something like The Golden Kite, The Silver Wind?
Yeah, indeed, yes. And she had, there was a kind of perfume or incense that was popular in the 20s, which had a crimson dragon ceramic container. It was just gorgeous. And she put that in the middle of the little stage with all the little carved figures and the curtains and the lights and everything. So I was there when she made her graduation dress, her gown, for the senior prom when she was 17, and the high school was only 3 blocks away, you see.
So she was just a young girl when
yeah,
you were...
She was born in 1911, and I came along, 1909, pardon me. She's
so still pretty close to your age, actually.
Oh, yeah, she's like an older sister.
Yeah.
So she's a combination of aunt, mother, and sister.
What happened to her? How did
she's
she
still alive.
Really?
Oh, yeah. She's almost 90 now, and she lives out in the valley, and I see her a couple times a year, especially on her birthday and Christmas. And up until recently, she was making dresses and teaching people dressmaking out in the valley. And over the years, she's had many, many students, and quite a few famous ones, too, movie stars who came to her and took dressmaking just to fill in their time, huh?
How did she feel about being the model for Cece? Did she ever talk about that?
No, we never have. It just never struck me, but it's obviously true.
Yeah.
And
so you were working on a subconscious level. Perhaps.
That's right. And then I dedicated the golden apples to her, of course. And she, at a certain time, gave me all of her Oz books, which I still have.
Oh.
And,
But did she ever marry or have children?
She was married for 2 weeks many years ago, and to a guy who I never met him, because this happened back east when I was in L.A., and it was obvious at the end of 2 weeks it just wasn't going to work.
That's too bad.
Sometimes that happens. So she's been a old maid lady for all of her life, but full of friends. And at the Disney studio last week, I was crossing the lot and someone yelled at me, and an old guy came up and said, is your Aunt Neva still okay? I said, sure. He said, well, I live up in Big Bear, and she has a cottage up there next to mine, and I gave her her golden retriever puppy that's been around her house all these years. And I said, oh, God, that's wonderful, because I see the dog all the time. He said, well, tell her that I love her, and we think that she's very special. And everyone talks that way. All the students I bump into years later at my lectures, they come up and say, I was taking a sewing class from Neva. Is she okay?
Now, what about your Uncle Einar? What about him might have led you to cast him as the
vampire figure. He was the loud Swedish uncle, and he worked for the hand laundry in Waukegan. And my mother'd have a certain amount of laundry that went out every week, and he'd come to the house and deliver it and talk, you know. And he was very loud and boisterous and full of laughter and, you know, irresistible. He was my favorite uncle, and he loved me as much as I loved him. And so when I came to write all these vampire stories, it was only natural that I'd give him wings. I thought he deserved wings. He should fly.
And there's that marvelous moment in Homecoming when he lifts Timothy up and makes him think that he's flying.
That's right.
Was that the kind of feeling you had?
Oh, yeah. And I gave I gave all these stories to Uncle Liner, and he was so proud. He was so pleased. And so all my Swedish uncles were six people in the Moberg family, my mother and two sisters and three brothers. And so I grew up among all the Swedish relatives. And
that's M-U-L-B-E-R-G? Moberg?
Moberg, M-O-B-E-R-G, And so my mother and Uncle Liner were the last ones to die. And my mother died 31 years ago yesterday, and my uncle died about 6 months before that, which was a devastation to me because, you know, it was hard to believe that someone so glorious was dead, And I'm still in touch with his daughter, Vivian, and she was my favorite girl cousin. And when you're 12 and you have a 14-year-old girl cousin, boy, you're in heaven, because you can do a lot of horsing around, you know. And I wrote a story about her. It's in my latest Driving Blind.
Oh, I love that. A House Divided.
Yeah.
I love that story.
So that's all true. That's happened.
Wonderful.
And that...
One body is lost and another body is claimed.
That's right.
Beautiful.
And the following day, 2 days later, was the funeral of my uncle. And on that afternoon, I ran down to the lakeshore and met Mr. Electrico.
Yeah.
So it was quite a week.
Well, now, so obviously you are Timothy.
That's right. Oh, yes.
And so did you sometimes feel a kind of alienation that Timothy feels? Most people feel alienated because they're eccentric or strange. Timothy is alienated because he's normal.
or not to other people, though, see. It already had begun in junior high and even earlier. And in high school, I was the alien because I wrote strange stories. I talked strangely. I cared for the wrong things. When I was in my last year at L.A. High, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out. I saw it four or five times. I made the mistake of telling my friends, and I was a pansy immediately.
Yeah.
In other words, boys are not supposed to like that sort of thing. Then, everything's changed since, thank God.
Yeah.
But the boys were merciless in making fun of me for liking that film. And I just thought it was the greatest film ever made at the time. And then when Fantasia came along, 3 or 4 years later, I dubbed that the greatest film ever made, and I have no reason to change my mind except Citizen Kane. I think the two of them together make my two favorite films of all time.
Same time, too.
But you see, I identified, for whatever reason, with The Hunchback of Notre Dame when I was 3 years old. Now, that's very peculiar, isn't it? Why would you identify with someone so deformed, and put upon? But maybe I could guess intuitively something about the world, or I don't know. Don't know.
Timothy, indeed, is a character of fine sensibilities, as James would
the
say.
The Phantom of the Opera the same way. Yeah. I identified with the Phantom, and boy, that changed my life.
Sure, indeed.
and the Lost World, all those three films between my third birthday and my sixth birthday really helped change me forever.
Had you attempted to put any of these characters or the Elliott family onto the page before The Homecoming, or was that the first?
I'm trying to remember now.
Maybe sketches or something before The Homecoming? That's 1946.
We've got to go back and look in Weird Tales and see.
Yeah.
See when Off the Liner was published.
There may be some germs in there, yeah. So yeah. That's right, as a story, that would have come before The Homecoming?
I think so.
Well,
you've got to look up the date.
I've got
now.
The Bradbury Companion. I can check
because
it out.
Because there was a time when I was in every issue of Weird Tales there during the 40s. And then in 1947, I think, is when I published The Homecoming with the illustration by Charles Adams, which I still have. He gave it to me.
So you think the Adams family might have been derivative?
I think it was just one of those coincidental things in the history of writing and illustration that we both had our families.
Yeah.
And then we sort of collided, and I was writing those stories in Weird Tales, and I sent The Homecoming to Mademoiselle because I'd sold them a couple of other stories in the years before, and they held the story for months. They didn't know what to do with them because it was too unusual for their magazine.
It has to be unlike any story of its kind I've ever seen.
Yeah. So instead of them changing the story, they changed the magazine. They got Catherine Ann Porter to write an article about haunted houses or something like that.
I'll be darned.
And various other articles tied in with Halloween.
I'll have to look up that issue.
Yeah, it's a whole Halloween issue of Mademoiselle. And I was trying to think who else they had in there.
Well, now, why did you name the family Elliott?
That's an interesting question. I don't know.
Because you use the name Elliott frequently.
Yeah, I use it as a pseudonym.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is that in your ancestry somewhere?
No, not that I know of.
And Spaulding, too. That always pops up.
Well, Spaulding's a family name. That's my father's middle name, Leonard Spaulding Bradbury.
Now, in 1946, when The Homecoming is written, this is a wild year for you. You meet Don Congdon. You meet your wife-to-be.
That's right.
This story comes out. Your first radio play, I think, is done.
Summer, yes.
What was going on with you in 1946?
Well,
cylinders are...
I was exploding. I was doing all the right things. I was writing to please myself, which I learned years before. I had all kinds of arguments with Weird Tales, and they wanted traditional ghost stories from me. I said, well, I can't do that. If I do it, they'll be lousy. You know, you can't make up a story. It has to happen, man. You have to have a metaphor that's so exciting, like skeleton, you know. After I went to my doctor, and I had a sore throat, and he looked in there, and he said, there's nothing wrong, it's a little red, you know. Take some aspirin and call me. And he said, I said, it feels kind of funny. He said, you've got a lot of things in your body that you've never really felt. He said, the medulla oblongata,
yes,
your floating ribs, you know, and your kneecap. So I left the office feeling my bones, huh? And
you named your dentist Munigant, and later you meet Mugnani. I mean, the two names are amazingly similar, which is strange.
That's interesting, yes. So I wrote the story sometime in the next week.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most popular stories I ever wrote.
But really, 46 must have been one of those benchmark years for you then.
Well, I began to sell to all kinds of magazines, and I appeared in the Best American Short Stories.
You won the O. Henry Award, didn't you, for
a year after that, with another story. I think The Homecoming
was the
O. Henry Award,
Is it fair to see that story as the germ from which so much is to come? I look at that story in astonishment. It's a fully mature, it's you in so many ways down the line. You know?
I suppose it opened me up because I began to experiment with more carnivals and circuses, and I did little prose poems, little paragraphs, a pensée, the French call them. People like Saint-Jean Peirce did whole books of pensée, which are nothing but paragraphs on a page, and they're prose poems, which is what most poetry is today. It isn't poetry at all. You should compact it down into a paragraph and say this is a pensée. It's an in-between form. So I learned years ago to experiment by writing pensée on a single page to establish an atmosphere or to describe a character and then see where in hell he was going to go.
But, you know, also what Stanley Weinbaum did in a story like Martian Odyssey, I think you're doing in The Homecoming, except he's dealing with extraterrestrials and you're dealing with freaks.
That's true.
Marginal characters, but you endow them with humanity. I don't think anybody had done anything like that before, do you? I see no precedent for that story.
No, that's what I set out to do. I knew I wanted to do a humane story about characters that ordinarily would be looked on with horror, you know. I mean, Dracula and Frankenstein's monster, though there are many. I think that happened first a century before, that you had a humane, sympathetic character. And maybe without knowing it, I was identifying with that, because the films, the Dracula film and the Frankenstein film, and the mummy's very sympathetic, you see.
Sure.
So I'm sure that was a huge influence when I saw that film when I was 12.
When Timothy goes up the stairs at the end, and he's weeping because he can't be different like them. That's an amazing moment. I mean, you really have the reader in a reverse situation there.
Yes.
We are crying for him because he can't be monstrous.
That's right.
That's a wonderful...
Well, we all like that. See, the Halloween is becoming the most popular holiday. Yeah. And the latest figures, it's gone up by the billions. Huh? And I told people about this years ago. They wouldn't listen. I had more trouble getting Halloween Tree reprinted in time for Halloween this year. They let it go by last year, so we missed a chance. Huh? And, of course, the Halloween Tree as an animated film is beautiful, and we got an Emmy with it. And I keep telling people, for Hallmark, I've tried to get them to do more with me, because they've begun to put out Halloween Trees without giving me credit.
Really?
Yeah.
How many stories can we think of now that deal with the family? There really aren't that many.
Well, I've written some new ones during the last year.
What got you into the idea of bringing back the family like this?
Well, it's been talked about for 40 years. 50 years. Yeah, I had meetings with Charlie Adams in New York City in 1946 because he had illustrated the story. And I had lunch with him at the New Yorker restaurant, hotel, with Sam Cobain, who was a popular New Yorker cartoonist. And we stayed in touch, and I made contacts with Helen Wolfe, and who had her own publishing group. And I can't remember the name of the publisher. So I had meetings during 46, and again in 1950 and 51, with all kinds of editors saying, Charlie Adams and I would like to do this book together.
No kidding, that would have been wonderful.
Yeah, but it just never happened. I got busy, he got busy. He became famous with his cartoons, so he didn't have time. And so then all the other things happened. But Don Congdon kept saying, you know, we still have to do this. So this week again, he's reading all the stories, including the new ones, and he's going to send me notes on this over the next weekend, because we've had a contract for for 2 years with Avon to finish it. But you see, I get so excited about other things, and I've done 3 screenplays in the last a year and a half, so that took a lot of time. I just didn't have time to look at the vampire book.
How many stories are you talking about?
Well, I'm trying to think now. Somewhere between 12 and 15. Some of them are little short things.
And now this includes the original set.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And then when did you begin to write new ones?
Oh, about 2 years ago.
You told me once about meeting a little boy in Paris.
Yes.
You've added his character. That's
I wrote a story.
Point.
He's in there.
Yeah. Which one is that called? Do you recall?
I think it's called Day. Okay. Because he's pure sunlight, right?
Exactly.
And,
now, have you added other members to the family, or are you just
there's some other people, yes. And
do we get to see Cece again?
Oh, yeah, she plays a part all the way through. And a grandma, the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandma from Egypt
yes.
is in there. I made notes on her 50 years ago. She's stacked in the attic. She looks like a bundle of old newspapers. And she's really a mummy, of course. And Timothy goes up there at night and talks to her. And she whispers with a rustling of newspaper, of the paper itself.
That's wonderful.
And he brings her sacramental wine, Egyptian wine. And she drinks it. And she tells him the history of the family. So in a way, she starts the book and begins to relate the stories of the various people.
Oh, I see.
And then you go to the next chapter and the story takes over.
So it's a framing device, I guess.
That's right.
Now, was this story written recently?
In the last 2 years,
okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you have the same setting in Greentown?
Yes. And I tell how they came there and settled in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, it's kind of an immigrant story, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Hey, there are relatives there from every country in the world. So,
And as you began to write anew about them, did you find yourself to be a different person, a different writer? Or
well,
did you go right back into where you had been years ago?
Well, you can never quite do that because, after all, I know more about writing now.
But did you have a new set of filters on writing about them?
You can't really say that. You just do the work, that's all.
But it must have felt kind of good to...
Oh, it felt good, sure. But you're not self-conscious about it. You just get it done and then decide later if the new stuff is good enough. And if it isn't, it doesn't go in.
What is the working title?
From the Dust Returned.
Okay. Now, where did you get that?
I don't know.
Is that a quote from something?
No, I can't remember.
It's beautiful.
It's terrible. It's a great title.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there other people? There must be legions of people like me out there wanting to hear more about the family. Do you hear from people like that?
Occasionally. Though most of the mail I get is on Dandelion Wine and Something Wicked, The Martian Chronicles. That's basically it. Fahrenheit, a lot of Fahrenheit the last few years.
Sure.
Because we're moving into this period now where we resemble the book, don't we?
Well, and you talked about people who become books. Now with the whole talking book technology, that's really sort of come to pass.
That's true.
Books are voices now. They're told like stories.
Of course, that's thousands of years old, isn't
it? Indeed it is, yeah.
There's a bookstore down in Houston or Dallas and called the Book People. Isn't that nice? They named for my characters.
Wonderful.
And there are 8 different Fahrenheit 451 bookstores all over the world. And there's one in Laguna again. It opened there 20 years ago, closed briefly a couple of years ago, and then it reopened again last spring. And then there's one in Bray, California. And there's another one in, I think, Denver. There's one in, Boston, somewhere back east.
Huh? Wish we had one here. You know, in Lawrence, however, you'll be interested to know, years ago, a bookstore opened up called Cougar and Darks.
Really?
Yes.
I'll be damned.
I found a copy of Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone in there with the foreword by Vincent Sterren. What a perfect book to find in a store like that. Huh?
Sure.
It was Sterren's. a small place.
Yeah, Sterren was very good.
Oh, I have a whole shelf of first editions.
Yeah.
Well, now, how about little cities? Are little cities calling themselves Greentown? Anything like that ever happened?
No, but there's a Bradbury place on the way to Palm Springs. It's a series of beautiful cottages. I think it's a small community where you buy a house into a series of maybe 20 houses, huh? And I've been meaning to stop there to find out if there's a relation to my family, and I never have. But could.
Well, what about the Greentown thing? Where did that come from? Because I've seen references to Melontown, too, in some of your books.
Yeah, that's the name I used originally for the vampire family. Yeah. I suppose I wanted something that suggested the look of the town. It's just that simple. But of course, now I went back to my hometown two or three times the last 10 years, and they've renamed the ravine that used to scare the hell out of me when I went through there with my brother after seeing Phantom of the Opera. They've renamed that Dandelion Trail, part of it, and part of it is Bradbury Park. So that's
you really put that place on the map, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a wonderful relationship.
Well, you know, I've often thought about going there to see it. Would I be disappointed? I mean, is it a real ravine?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't go down there at night for anything, even this late. It's not all that deep, but, you know, it's deep enough, and there's a lot of wild shrubbery and trees, and they've rebuilt the stairs going down, which I used in my story about the summer night. And
right, Lavinia.
Lavinia. And they rebuilt the stairs and the bridge. So now, and then at the top of the trail, Dandelion Trail, leading up to the top of the hill, they put a little monument to me, to Ray Bradbury, "We Remember You, We Remember You," from my poem. When I saw that, I burst into tears. When I was there with my Aunt Neva, I took her back with me for the dedication of the park. And I took my girlfriend from first grade, I called her in Michigan, and she came with her daughter, Isabel Skelton, and I walked her to school every day for 7 or 8 years in Central School.
What about the house that the Elliots lived in? Is that based on your grandfather's house?
That's, yes.
Because you discuss that in Dandelion Wine when Doug goes up to the tower.
Of course, I've made it bigger than it really is, and there's no tower on it. I borrowed the tower from another house down the street. You see, I always wanted one of those.
Oh, yes.
And you can see things from the top floor of my grandparents' house, and but I always wanted a tower of my own.
Are any of those structures still standing?
My grandparents' house is still there. It's beautifully painted, thank God. I went inside 10, 15 years ago. I took pictures looking out through the colored glass windows.
Oh, yes.
Of course, I've used those two or three times.
Man upstairs.
Yeah, and in my Martian story, the strawberry window.
Right.
Yeah. And the house I was born in is still there and kept up. And see, my Aunt Neva lived upstairs there for a long while. She had her studio right above. So all I had to do is go upstairs.
Now, which house was this again?
Where the house I was born in, on 11th South St. James Street.
Yeah, those are the most powerful years for us in terms of formative impact, influence.
Yes, yes.
And it's a shame that so many children, I think, go through those years not noticing what's happening to them.
Well, I think it's the history of the world. I don't think anything's different today than it was then. Most people didn't read, even when there were libraries. And my brother's never read a book in his life. So, you know, every family's different. People are always saying, well, your reading's diminished. Well, yes and no. We published 20,000 new books last year. It's a hell of a lot of books. And there are those people who read and those who don't. I have three daughters who read, and I have one daughter who doesn't. She's raised a huge family. She's got five kids. So she's the professional mama. And she can teach us about life, you see. She didn't have to read a book. This is beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a shame that so many children, I think, go through those years not noticing what's happening to them.
Well, I think it's the history of the world. I don't think anything's different today than it was then. Most people didn't read, even when there were libraries. And my brother's never read a book in his life. So, you know, every family's different. People are always saying, well, your reading's diminished. Well, yes and no. We published 20,000 new books last year. It's a hell of a lot of books. And there are those people who read and those who don't. I have three daughters who read, and I have one daughter who doesn't. She's raised a huge family. She's got five kids. So she's the professional mama. And she can teach us about life, you see. She didn't have to read a book. This is beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. This is, we're in an area called Fairway. We're in Kansas City, but technically we're in a suburb called Fairway. And you'll find Kansas City is a very open kind of city with pockets of concentrated structures.
Yeah.
We're just going to go straight this way for another couple of minutes, and we'll be into the plaza that I told you about.
Yeah.
With the Spanish-style architecture.
Yes. I talked to my architectural friend, John Gerdy, on the phone an hour ago. He celebrated his 20th year as an architect in L.A., and I was part of his firm for a while 12 years ago, and I helped create the Horton Plaza in San Diego and the Glendale Galleria was based on my plan, and the West Side Pavilion. So I was in and out of his group many mornings, oh God, 15 years ago.
Well, I think you're going to be interested in this development. As I told you, it goes back to 1920, 21, when such an idea in America, at least, it's almost like a plaza, you know.
Well, he told me he was working here with his group.
Oh, really?
And that I should go over and look at the Light and Power Building.
Power and Light Building. Now, that's on downtown. We can swing down that way, too, if you like.
Because he wanted me to go look. He's taking over that whole area and rebuilding and recreating it.
There's a huge complex that's planned for the downtown area.
Yeah. Well, that's
the Power and Light District, they're
calling. So I just talked to him. I promised him I'd go look.
Okay.
And I'm going to go see him next week. But we used to have a lot of fun. I'd go over there at 7 in the morning, which is unheard of. I've never been up at 7 o'clock in the morning. But I get up at 6. But I turned it down. And
now, coming up on us is this plaza area. I'll turn left and we'll go on through it. But see, all of these boulevards, the city is dotted, striped with these boulevards going everywhere. There's more miles of boulevard in this city than any city in the world except Paris.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's weird. And this area up here, we're coming up on it. Now, these are apartment buildings, so that doesn't count.
Yeah.
But
some lovely homes here.
Let's go on in here. At Thanksgiving time, they have a huge ceremony where tens of thousands of lights are illuminated that line all of the buildings. And this is Brush Creek. And you can start to see some of the architecture I was telling you about ahead. This creek runs all along this side.
It's wonderful.
Now we're into the plaza proper. what I'll do is I'll circle around. I'll go down this way first.
Now, is this the area he was talking about?
I think, well, now the Power and Light District is farther downtown.
I see.
This is the Spanish-style plaza area I was telling you about. There's a kind of vaguely Moroccan influence here.
Very nice.
We'll go back through another street.
Okay.
But all around you, there's a certain consistency in some of the architecture. And this is the place to be, to shop and hang out and have your cappuccino, you know?
Oh, sure.
And all that. There's little courtyards and things like that.
Very nice.
But most cities have to do this within recent years. This has been here since the 20s.
Yeah. Well, some city fathers know what cities are, and most of them don't. My hometown is a devastation.
Oh, that must be sad when you go back.
All the big theaters, and the malls are outside town, of course, and they could have brought them in. They just didn't.
How large a town was it growing up?
It was 33,000, and it's around 100,000 now.
Wow. So originally it was about the size of Lawrence then, where we mm-hmm. were.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, every city I go to almost is let itself be destroyed because mm-hmm. the city, the mayor and the city fathers didn't understand what was going on.
Well, we've got quite a line of cars here.
Yeah.
My goodness. There are no stoplights. Well, there is here, but there are long stretches through there where there's no stoplights. You just, cars, pedestrians just work their way along.